In our previous episode, we talked about living under the ancient curse of the Tower of Babel.
So the curse of Babel is an existential condition in which we live every day. We use language to communicate, but we cannot rely on it to make ourselves understood.
We can't always rely on it because...
Well, we have 7,000 languages.
7,000 languages? We learned about the many costs associated with this linguistic diversity. Financial costs, psychic costs, even war.
So many people died in the war, which, in fact, easily could have been avoided.
And we learned that linguistic diversity has plenty of benefits, too.
There are certainly claims about types of thinking that become very hard without language or become unlikely without language.
That's our current world, Earth 1.0. But today, we're imagining how we would communicate if we could start all over again. On Earth 2.0, it might be nice if all 7+ billion of us had one common language. And then, as suggested by Columbia linguist John McWhorter...
And that then people have another language that they use with their in-group, and that we have as many of those languages as possible.
This, McWhorter says, is pretty close to the way a lot of people already communicate.
If you think about the typical person who speaks Arabic, for example, they almost certainly speak two different languages. There's the Arabic that we would learn in a book, and then there's either Moroccan Arabic or Iraqi Arabic or Sudanese Arabic, Libyan Arabic. Those are completely different languages from standard Arabic, different basic words, different grammatical constructions. And so you grow up speaking your Libyan Arabic. That's, you know, mommy's language. And then when you go to school, you learn something that often I've heard people from these countries also call Arabic. And that's this other language. That happened because of history, because of cultural history. In the case of Arabic, the Quran and the religious unity of the nations has a lot to do with it. But ideally, nobody would have to go to school to, quote unquote, learn Arabic. And that sort of thing is going on in many South Asian countries. It's what a typical African often has to go through. Or, you know, if you're Sicilian, you speak Sicilian, you go to school and you learn Italian.
Okay, fine. But then there's a task of selecting the universal language. Here's Michael Gordon, a historian of science at Princeton.
Even if we picked a universal language that was neutral, politics being what it is, and I doubt this could be engineered away, we'd find ways to particularize the previously general.
But it'd be interesting if there was some sort of academy that were designed to keep people from making it more complicated.
I love that the linguist is coming up with the academy to keep language from becoming more complicated, because you guys are the ones that have contributed, obviously, to the way we think about language is so complicated.
See, we contain multitudes.
It might be helpful to look at some of the countries that already use formulas calling for two or three languages.
The Indians, actually, in some other countries, in Nigeria, Kazakhstan, they try to implement this formula.
That's Shlomo Weber, an economist and director of the New Economic School in Moscow.
They try to combine all these things. So every child has to study his own language, English, and the language of the other part of the country. So everything beautiful, you bring national cohesiveness, you bring efficiency through English, and you still sustain your individual languages, your individual attachment, your identification. But it didn't work because the people didn't accept this formula. And why didn't accept it? Because the attachment to own language was much stronger than doing anything else.
I thought that Kazakhstan worked better than, let's say, India or Nigeria. So what did Kazakhstan do, or what happened there that made it work better?
Well, they have a strong government there. But you see, in the case of Kazakhstan, I think the people were convinced that this is the right way to go. Because in Kazakhstan, with its oil and gas resources, its English is very, very important to be a part of the international community. Of course, Kazakh language is important as their own language, but they also recognize that for cohesiveness of the country, Russian is important language.
But you're also suggesting that authoritarianism is handy if you want to get everybody to speak the three languages, yeah? Because democracy is a little sloppier.
Well, a little sloppy in this regard, right? Some other advantages, but not that, yeah.
To be fair, there are a lot of differences between Kazakhstan and India. India is much larger, much more diverse. Even so, says Michael Gordon,
you have to give people a reason to want to engage with the language. The energy required to learn a language is high enough that you really have to work on the motivation. And the constructed languages and the natural languages provide lots of examples of the importance of that.
Okay, so how do people engage with a language, especially if it's not the one they learned to speak as a child? Are the upsides of a universal language worth the downsides? That's coming up today on Freakonomics Radio.
Dari NYC Studio.
Mulasa WNYC Studios.
Dari Studio WNYC.
WNYC Studios.
Ici, c'est la Radio Freakonomics.
Radio Freakonomics.
С вами Radio Freakonomics.
Radio Freakonomics.
The show that explores the hidden side of everything.
Ведущий программы.
Voici votre présentateur.
Steven Dubner.
So what would happen if we chose English as the new universal language? I mean, with 1.5 billion speakers, it's already 20% of the way there. What would you do to make English truly accessible to everyone, especially non-native speakers?
Something that we must get rid of is linguistic prescriptivism. And by that, I mean that we live within an idea that some ways of speaking a language are bad, broken, and some ways aren't. It's all based on myths. And that's not to say that in a formal situation, you can get up and say, Billy and me went to the store.
In the 19th century, the standard by which people had to know a language, a foreign language that wasn't their own. So let's, for the moment, pretend like everybody in the world speaks either French, English, or German. You had to be really fluent in one of those three, but only pretty competent in the others, a much weaker level of fluency. So the French person didn't have to know a lot of English, but they had to be able, with a dictionary, to puzzle their way through a scientific article. So you could relax the assumption that everything has to be perfect grammar book English and just allow the publication of rougher English in a variety of forms without this obsessive copy editing. That would be fairer.
I mean, there are some kinds of English that would be so difficult for anybody else to understand that maybe there would have to be some adjustment. But schematically, the idea that most people in most nations have to learn a form of what they speak that requires effort to master, that's crummy.
You could imagine subsidizing global English education. Another fairer option is to say, no, we actually really like the highly readable, clean English. But you could charge slightly higher page fees for native speakers of English that would subsidize copy editing for non-native speakers of English.
I think the most important thing would be to provide incentives for linguistic innovation or for bringing language and the arts together, for bringing language and engineering together.
That's Esther Shore, a professor of English at Princeton.
And this would have to come from some kind of organization or donors, of course. But that's as much of an institution as I would like to imagine negotiating language in Earth 2.0.
I would like to have a peace on this planet and then to approach those things.
What do you think would be a better way for everyone in the world to learn English? I'm especially curious to know, as an economist, what you think is the ROI on an education dollar versus like an entertainment dollar. In other words, would it be better just to have all Hollywood movies distributed globally for free? Would that be the best way for people to learn English?
It could be the case. You know, once again, example of India, where the Bollywood movies contributed to tremendous development of Hindi. You know, the language was not spoken very widely in India before the development of Bollywood.
I mean, maybe like even 5 years from now, a technology like movies will seem very old-fashioned because, you know, there may be technology that's essentially instant and perfect translation from any language to any language, right?
Of course, the technology will play a part.
To be fair, technology is already playing a huge part. Google just came out with new earphones called Pixel Buds that translate over 40 languages in real time. There's also the rapidly developing Skype translator. You might think that this translation boom and the digital revolution generally would especially help smaller languages. But so far, at least, that is not necessarily true. The internet is dominated by what John McWhorter calls the big dude languages, especially English. Google searches in English return roughly four times more results than Arabic searches. 95% of Wikipedia concepts are represented in fewer than six languages. There is, of course, no guarantee this march toward English hegemony continues. History shows us that language is inherently mutable. So what can we assume about the future of language?
Since we're not changing the biology of humans, we can assume a couple of things.
Michael Gordon again.
That people will learn languages, that they'll learn them pretty well when they're kids, and that languages won't stay stable. And if you want a more broadly communicative, more inclusive infrastructure, you should focus on training children while they're young and still able to learn multiple different languages and keeping them straight. In the 19th century in Bohemia, the Czech region of the Habsburg Empire, it was quite common for neighboring peasant villages, one of which was predominantly German-speaking and one of which was predominantly Czech-speaking, to send kids to be educated in the other town. So that way the kid would know both languages.
So that's one solution to cross-pollinate local languages, but there's another larger solution, a truly universal language, a second language that everyone around the world learns in addition to their native tongue. It'd be a simple, flexible language that's not burdened by imperialism or nativism, perhaps a language like Esperanto. It was created in the 19th century by a Jewish ophthalmologist named Ludovic Lazarus Zamenhof. It is a language both idealistic and pragmatic.
It's called Esperanto because that was his pseudonym, Doctoro Esperanto, which means the hopeful one. And he brags in this initial pamphlet that you can learn it in an afternoon, you know, that and that it's fun. So it was supposed to be easy to learn and easy to pronounce.
Esperanto was derived from various European roots. Zamenhof's idea was not to have Esperanto displace other languages.
He called it a helping language or an auxiliary language. It would stand next to national languages and be a helping language to make bonds among people who were not like one another.
Zamenhof was a universalist.
But he was also a universalist who understood what it meant to have warm feelings for one's people. And Esperanto was to somehow reconcile those two things. It was to try to breed in us these feelings of attachment for other people who were really quite unlike us.
The larger goal of Esperanto was nothing less than world peace.
He knew that language could be a wall between ethnicities, but that it could also be a bridge. And that was his motivation, to build a language that would be a bridge among ethnicities. And he modeled it on the teaching of Hillel, do not unto others as you would not have them do unto you. Hillel was a first century rabbi, so it had a very Jewish cast to it.
This did not help Esperanto's cause. As Esther Shore told us, anti-Semitism changed the fortunes of Esperanto when the French demanded that Zamenhof shear away its religious ideology. Hitler and Stalin would also reject Esperanto. Regardless, if you remove its religious and utopian components, what's left, Esther Shore says, is a language with some substantial benefits over many other languages, whether existing or invented.
What he wanted was maximal flexibility and simplicity. So for one thing, the verbs are all regular in Esperanto. He wanted a language that was egalitarian and neutral. He didn't want people to be disadvantaged because they weren't a native speaker. And he speaks very movingly about what it's like to try to speak a language that's not your own. And he talks about his pulse racing and his palms sweating. You know, it's an experience I've had. Perhaps you have had it also.
So Esperanto is a lot easier to learn than other languages because it has very regular rules and very regular grammar.
That's Ruth Kevis-Cohen. She helped develop an online Esperanto course for the language site Duolingo.
And that's where you find that it's taking you a lot less time than you thought to learn the language. So here's a sentence in Esperanto. Mi estas knabo. I am a boy. There is no in Esperanto. Knabo, you can see, is a noun because it has an O at the end. Every noun ends in the letter O. Every adjective ends in the letter A. Every verb in the present ends in as, as. So you already know that. Estas is, am, are. It's the same. There's no conjugation of that.
Still, for all its thoughtfulness and pragmatism, Esperanto never got anywhere close to its intended universal status, what Esperantists refer to as la fina venko, the final victory. Why not?
Well, I can answer that by looking at what does look like a universal language in our world, which is English. What looked like a universal language in Zamenhof's day was French. And both French and English were propelled into the world by commerce and armies. And Esperanto had neither of those.
So you may be somewhat surprised to learn that this invented, non-native 19th century language is still being spoken.
These days, the most informed estimates I hear are several hundred thousand people speak Esperanto. And the strength of Esperanto is not in numbers. The strength of Esperanto is in its continuity over 130 years in 62 countries from generation to generation without being passed down from generation to generation.
Coming up next, let's meet some of these Esperantists, and we'll find out what binds them together beyond the language.
If I were in a group like this, and I needed somebody to hold my wallet with all my money in it, I would hand it to an Esperanto speaker in full confidence that whenever I came back, they would hand it back to me and my money would still be in it.
And for more Freakonomics Radio, check out our podcast archive at Freakonomics.com on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast outlet you like.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
So today you're going to meet people who are taking time off of work, who are spending money to go and participate in this weird Esperantujo, as they call it, this weird Esperanto land that only exists temporarily wherever all these weirdos meet together.
That's Christopher Johnson. This Esperanto land he's talking about is a gathering of Esperantists for the USA National Congress, or Landa Congresso, as you say it in Esperanto. Our producer, Stephanie Tam, spent a couple days with them at William Peace University in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah, they must like you then.
Well, this is my fourth year here in Raleigh, and as I was driving in from the west, we got to the first highway sign that said Raleigh, 55 miles, and I said, it's like coming home. It's just like, oh, we're almost there. This is so exciting. We're there. We're there.
That's Lee Miller, a 65-year-old Texan and former sign language interpreter and nurse. He learned Esperanto at 16. Now he teaches it in his retirement. He and another Esperantist picked me up from the airport and drove me to campus.
And I really have that sense of excitement about, I know the place. We know the staff at the university now, and they know us. Oh, it's the Esperanto people. We're glad to have you back, and we're glad to be back.
You know that something interesting and sweet is happening when you feel that you're returning home to a place that you only visit once a year.
I know, and it's not really home, but these are people who are important to me. I don't know if you know the old musical Brigadoon. It was about a little village in the countryside that only appeared one day a year. And there's a love story connected with it. But sometimes I kind of have the sense that our summer Esperanto gatherings are a little bit like that. We go away for most of the year, and then during a week or two, we come back and we get together and we have face-to-face interactions. And it is very sweet. Sweet is a good word for it.
A lot of Esperantists describe their community as a kind of family. Somewhat ironic, as the joke among Esperantists is that many spouses don't share the language, so their actual everyday family might not know Esperanto at all. And yet,
if I were in a group like this and I needed somebody to hold my wallet with all my money in it, I would hand it to an Esperanto speaker in full confidence that whenever I came back, they would hand it back to me and my money would still be in it. I have that level of confidence and trust in the people I know. Welcome to William Peace University.
Thank you. Wow. The National Congress is a combination of socializing, workshops, and seminars, and a dose of admin meetings about running the USA Association. This year, there were about 70 attendees, with guests flying in from Canada, the Netherlands, and elsewhere, and about 1,000 streaming from Facebook Live. For the past several years, the National Congress has been followed by an 8-day Esperanto summer course where people can learn the language. This year, they had 58 students. Both events are held at William Peace, a fitting home for a language born with the goal of world unity. That internal idea of Esperanto, or what Esperantists call la interna ideo, pardon my accent, was originally rooted in Jewish universalism and remains a connecting thread. But humans being the fickle, creative creatures that they are, it's been adapted throughout history for some very different ends.
The history of Esperanto involves socialists in the early 1920s who wanted to use Esperanto to further the goals of socialism.
That's Esther Shore, English professor and Esperanto scholar at Princeton University. We spoke a few weeks before the Congress.
It involves Bolshevism. The Soviets embraced Esperanto for a period of time until they changed their minds and shot the Esperantists in 1938. There was a very short-lived Nazi Esperanto movement. And Esperanto has been used for a number of other kinds of causes, for pacifism, for green consciousness, et cetera, et cetera.
This year's keynote speaker was Humphrey Tonkin, an English professor at the University of Hartford and former president of the Universal Esperanto Association. His speech highlighted what he considers the unjust dominance of English today. But he also recalled the original founding principles of the language. He delivered the speech in Esperanto and gave me an English translation afterward.
Zamenhof emphasized that first and foremost, we're human beings, and only secondarily, members of particular nations or peoples or languages. If appealing to what is best in humanity, rather than reinforcing what divides us, is idealistic or utopian, I suppose we must plead guilty. But if using what brings us together to talk about and celebrate what makes us all different is a rational approach to our divided world, then Esperanto seems to me to make a great deal of sense. I know what you, here in Raleigh at this gathering of Esperanto speakers, think. Esperanto works, and you're going to keep on using it and convincing others to do the same.
Despite that common internal idea, whether you want to call it utopianism, universalism, etc., I discovered that people come to Esperanto for all sorts of reasons. Some are polyglots who just love learning languages. Others are programmer types who appreciate its logic. And then there are those with a sense of adventure.
I'm originally from Cuba, where I also was part of the Esperanto movement. In the real life, I work as a professor of chemistry in Santa Rosa Junior College in Santa Rosa, California.
That's Orlando Rayola, who recently finished his 6-year term as president of Esperanto USA.
Having been born in an island, being an islander by nature, I always had this great curiosity, what is beyond the sea? What is the world out there? And I understood early that the only way to communicate with humans is through language. And I was fascinated, interested in many different cultures.
That said, his fascination with the world beyond didn't lead him straight to Esperanto.
I was always fascinated by the culture of Nordic countries, especially of Sweden. I once wrote a letter to the Swedish Institute. It's a Swedish institution that disseminates Swedish culture outside Sweden. And I sent them a letter. I want to learn this language. I want to get to know about this culture. A few months later, I got a big package with everything you need to know to learn Swedish. Dictionaries, cassettes, courses for learning the language, reading material. I mean, it was a big box. I said, this is a very difficult language. I'm going to spend how many years to learn this? And then I will be able to communicate with a very tiny sliver of mankind. I am very interested in the culture, but so am I am in the culture of Japan and of Hungary and of China. And, you know, do I have time to learn of these languages? No, there won't be time. So when I tried to go through it, that day, that's the day I became an Esperantist.
So for some people, learning Esperanto is a way to follow their cultural curiosity. For others, though, there are war stories.
My name is Maria Murphy. I'm retired, have two wonderful boys and four wonderful grandchildren. It takes a special person, I think, to be really devoted Esperanto follower. And happened to me, I'm the one.
She's a petite grandma with a cheeky smile, astoundingly upbeat given her past.
I grew up in Warsaw. I am, you could call me a Holocaust survivor. You know, I'm from the Jewish family that everybody was killed. Apparently, I was a quiet baby, and I was constantly eating, I mean, at mommy's breast, so I was not crying. You know, people were suffocating their own babies if they start crying.
After the war, she and her mother left Poland.
We decided to immigrate to Israel, and on the way, we stopped in France, and we stopped in Italy, and as a very young girl, I picked up those languages pretty quickly on the street, and I just felt that people should be able to talk to each other, no matter where you are. And here, I mean, 8-9-year-old girl, I had this strong experience. Every country, every day I spoke different language, you know, so there should be a better way.
For Murphy, that better way was Esperanto, which she stumbled upon as a teenager. She and her mother had returned to Poland, and she came across an ad for an Esperanto club.
You see, at that time, I didn't have really society. I didn't have any place that I felt I belonged to. Because most of the Polish people are very strong Catholic. So when I found group of people that meeting like twice a week and having wonderful discussion, drinking good coffee, eating good cake, and they were young people, it was very natural to become a part of it.
Murphy would actually meet her husband through Esperanto. Which brings us to another reason that people join the community, the love stories. Joel and Zhenya Amos were a Cold War couple who also met through Esperanto. Zhenya's from Ukraine, Joel from Atlanta. They had both applied for the same job, an editor position, for an Esperanto magazine based in the Netherlands but operated remotely. Zhenya snagged the top position.
They just asked, so who was this other candidate? And it was some guy from the U.S., and I just asked, can you send me his resume? And well, I was looking at it, I like this guy. He looks so intelligent. I'll try to hire him to be my assistant.
You didn't have a photo. It was just on paper, just to be clear. And so we worked together for like a year and a half or so before we ever met in person.
Work aside, they insist there's a more fundamental way Esperanto connected them.
Esperanto, it's not just a language. It's really, it's a, almost like a value system, right?
I would agree. When I look back at the person I was in my early teens before I became an Esperantist, I don't really recognize that person anymore. I grew up as a Christian and I still am, but my approach is much different. And at first, it was just a linguistic interest, you know, kind of like a game. I didn't have anyone locally to speak to. So the Esperanto community brought me into contact with people that I wouldn't have had contact with otherwise. I had pen pals in Eastern Europe or wherever, you know, in these places that were so far away from me culturally. And it almost sounds evangelical to talk about it like that, but for me, at least, it was a catalyst that changed the course of my life from where maybe if I hadn't learned Esperanto, I might just be in Georgia in a small town, you know, not having traveled or anything like that. When I grew up, I heard that the Soviet Union wanted to drop bombs on us. And, you know, this is the enemy. And she heard, you know, how awful
the story the other way around,
you know, and you know, how do we get to, you know, being married from that point, you know, growing up in such different places, a different mindset. I think for both of us, Esperanto was that catalyst. What we have in the Esperanto community is kind of like a microcosm for what could be or what should be. This community that spans languages, political ideologies, religions, races, on a small scale, this is the world that Zamenhof dreamed of.
Talking with Esperantists, I felt like I was interacting with an epic metaphor: linguistic communication as human community. The notion that a universal language could create world peace seemed too romantic. What about civil wars, where both parties shared the language? But at the same time, it was clear that there was something special going on. Miller, Amos, Murphy, and these other Esperantists had used this language to create a kind of small-scale utopia. Up next, we get into pragmatics. Could Esperanto, for instance, save the European Union a lot of money in education costs?
He concluded that actually it would be cheaper to have Esperanto play that kind of intermediary role.
We discover how travel in this small-scale utopia works.
Basically, you just show up and they usually give you a key to their homes.
And we ask, could that sense of trust and community be retained if the microcosm were scaled up?
If Esperanto were to become a universal language, I think things like this would die.
That's coming up next.
En la venonta discutemos.
Tiu venas jus poste ĉe Freakonomics Radio.
On Freakonomics Radio.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
Welcome back to Freakonomics Radio. Here again is producer Stephanie Tam.
For all its idealism, Esperanto also has a deeply pragmatic side. It was designed to be easy to learn and, in a word, efficient, which makes it a language that appeals not only to dreamers, activists, and ambassadors, but also economists.
As a professor at the University of Geneva who studied this, François Grin, and actually the French government asked him to make a study of language costs in Europe.
That's Duncan Charters, professor of languages and cultures at Principia College in Illinois, where he teaches Spanish.
And he concluded that actually it would be cheaper to have Esperanto play that kind of intermediary role.
How much cheaper? Back in 2005, Grin calculated that substituting the high cost of learning English with the low cost of Esperanto in non-English-speaking countries could save the EU upwards of 25 billion euros annually.
The French government wasn't looking for that answer. They wanted something different involving French, but actually that was a very good point, I think. And the cost of learning Esperanto is less just because it's so much quicker.
How much quicker? Well, obviously, ease of language learning depends on all kinds of factors. Natural ability, age of acquisition, regular practice. But one study with a sample of Francophone children found that just 150 hours of Esperantic education resulted in the same level of proficiency as 1,000 hours of Italian, 1,500 hours of English, and 2,000 hours of German, making Esperanto an average of 10 times faster to learn than these natural languages. So what makes it so much faster and easier to learn?
There are 16 basic rules of the language. For example, every noun ends in the letter O. Every adjective ends in the letter A. Every infinitive ends in the letter I. The future, present, and past have totally regular endings. There's no need to learn any conjugations. They don't exist in Esperanto.
So that's Ruth Kevis-Cohen, a geriatrics doctor in Maryland. In Esperanto, she goes by her middle name. In her spare time, she helped develop an Esperanto course for the online language site Duolingo, which she used to try and teach me Esperanto.
This is lesson one of the Duolingo course, which starts out showing some pictures. Mm. Which of these is man?
I see a picture of a man with a Viro. I'm going to click that one.
La Viro.
By putting your finger here, you can see what it is. The word la means the.
Hmm.
So just like in English, the is la. There's no plural form.
There's no conjugation with that. It's
right.
Just LA is always the. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Okay. Well, that is a commonality with English that I think
right.
makes it simpler than French.
So to say I speak, we say mi parolas. I speak. Mi parolas. Mi parolas Esperanton. Kai vi, ĉu vi parolas Esperanton?
So, mi parolas.
Parolas
Esperanton. And that's an O-N. Is that the ending for a noun?
O is the ending for a noun, and we add the N because it's a direct object.
Ah, oh, interesting. Okay, yeah. So then it's only the subjects that end in O, really. Oh, does that mean that my name, so if I said something like, greeted Stephanie, would it become Stephanie-on?
If the name ends in O, then we can add the N. But if it doesn't end in O, we just leave it the way it is.
Okay. So Zamenhof originally wrote up 16 rules for the language, a couple of which you just heard. Nouns end in O, direct objects in N, and every word is phonetic. He also compiled 900 roots, derived mostly from Romance languages, which Esperantists then built into a rich vocabulary.
Users have taken these roots, which are very flexible, and made words for new occasions, for new moments, for new technologies.
Esther Shore, Princeton Esperanto scholar again.
So, for example, the word for a cell phone is poche telefono. It's a pocket phone. The word for a smartphone is lertofono, a smartphone, literally. But I know an Esperantist who refers to his smartphone as kromcerbo, which means a spare brain. So there's a lot of wit, there's a lot of invention, there's a lot of play involved in coining words.
Duncan Charters also argues that Esperanto, in addition to being efficient and inventive, can serve as a gateway language.
The good thing about it is, once someone gets into a language that has enabled them to communicate with people around the world, they then want to learn other languages. It's sort of a natural consequence. And for me, then, it's not so much of an effort and a struggle to get students interested. It becomes more natural. Just as in Europe, people much more naturally learn other languages, it's because they've had a practical experience with the ones that they've learned.
Okay, but practical experience? How does that work if Esperantists may not even be able to find other people nearby to speak the language?
There is a system called Pasporta Servo, which means passport service. And it's a network of Esperantists who agree to host visiting Esperantists, usually young people, for up to 3 nights free of charge. And there's an enormous degree of trust in this Esperanto world. And the word on the street is you arrive and someone hands you their car keys and goes to work.
As it turns out, Esperantists were practicing couch surfing before it became a thing. Pasporta Servo started in 1974 as a small print booklet listing 39 hosts. It's since moved online, and the latest edition contains 974 hosts from 81 countries. Again and again, I'd hear these stories from Esperantists who had traveled all over the world.
I don't know if you realize that almost in every country there's Esperanto club, and it has been happening since like 130 years. And if you like the word, then it's your oyster.
I got to know what is living inside a Japanese family is for 2 months, talk to them and eat their food and go with them to places.
I've traveled quite a bit in Spanish-speaking countries using Esperanto contacts, and I've always found that those are the ones that really get me into the culture more.
Since I came to this country, I was lucky to meet Esperanto people who were helpful, and I start immediately traveling around the country for different conventions. I bought myself a ticket on Greyhound. I went all over the country. You know, it was $99, if you don't remember, but that was in the 60s. So yeah. I had a lot of fun.
I went to Kazakhstan this past year. This guy and his friend, Vyacheslav, and his friend drove me 300 kilometers in a whole day touring some ancient historical sites, and that was pretty amazing.
I have been to so many places, met so many people, have so many friends with which I feel at home, always contacting Esperantists everywhere. Yes, I have satisfied whatever curiosity of the islander beyond the sea has been satisfied.
Do you feel like the Esperantists are exceptionally helpful and have that kind of bond with you because it's a
niche community that you select into, as opposed to English being just more common?
So I think that definitely helps.
That's Christopher Johnson, a 29-year-old software engineer from North Carolina.
It almost takes a naive idealism to believe in Esperanto, or at least in that idea that you can make the world a better place by speaking a language. If you're dedicated enough to learn this language and spend your time on it, you have to have that similar idealism. We have to have things in common. The other nice thing is there's no real Esperanto land where you can go. So I don't think I would have ever met somebody from Cuba without Esperanto. But it just naturally happened because you start meeting people in this small community and people come from all over the world to kind of visit these things.
Yeah, and I guess I'm curious about how you kind of think through the tension between what seems to be this kind of transcendent, you know, international aspect that reaches out and is very open to people and, you know, attracting more people to Esperanto, and the potential that if it actually continued spreading, that you wouldn't actually have that kind of, you know, sweet community anymore.
Sharp question. And I do understand that if Esperanto begins to become much larger in society, that some of the selling points of today will vanish.
Yes, I would not give my car keys to everyone. If Esperanto were to become a universal language, I think the negatives would be that things like this would die. The Lando Congresso, why would people want to travel miles and miles to meet other Esperantists if you can easily find them everywhere? So we would have to find the next big idealistic improvement, maybe, to come and meet and talk about for hours, or other interests that we share.
I found it fascinating that even this most idealistic language could be as much a boundary as a bridge, and that its ability to bridge might even require boundaries to create social trust between Esperantists. But then again, if Esperanto has survived through self-selection decade after decade into this paradoxically idealistic and pragmatic language, then maybe its universality could only result from a world in which people universally chose to become idealistic and pragmatic. And who knows? Maybe in that world, we could trust strangers with our home and car keys.
And the strength of Esperanto is not in numbers. The strength of Esperanto is in its continuity over 130 years without being passed down from generation to generation, without having money, without having armies. And there it is. It's really remarkably beautiful.
For now, despite stirrings of excitement about the uptick of Esperanto, very few in the community really believe that the day Zamenhof dreamed of, la fina venco, or the final victory, will be coming any time in the near future. But in the meantime, those who learn it today have created a quirky, brigadoonish family of visionaries. And for all its unworldliness, Esperanto is considered the world's most successful invented language. Still, in some ways, the story of Esperanto teaches us as much about what makes a language fail as succeed. The power of, well, power, and politics and economics.
The cases where someone has actually tried to construct a fair and ostensibly neutral form, things like Esperanto, are widely treated as ridiculous or implausible.
That's Michael Gordon, a historian at Princeton University. He's studied the brief use of Esperanto for scientific communication in the early 1900s.
So even those people who try to come up with something calmer and kinder don't often get rewards commensurate with that.
But it also perhaps raises some questions about our world. What does it say about us that we find a language that combines peace and pragmatism ridiculous or implausible? And could it be that idealism just might be rational?
The world, the humankind, does not act very rationally. I teach chemistry, as I said, and I tell my students, you know, If people were rational, don't you think that we should have long before adopted general international system of units everywhere? Well, but we don't. We still measure things in gallons and yards and feet. So in that sense, it might not be in a short term that Esperanto, that is a rational solution for international communication, becomes like the language of choice. But the important thing, and what I always consider to be the goal of the movement, is keep it alive, keep it functioning, keep it suitable for expression of everything the human has to express. Because maybe, I don't know when, but when and if mankind finds itself ready for it, we need to have it alive. We need to have it ready. You can't say, oh, now we're going to create it. No, no, no. Here it is. Take it. It's yours.
That was Stephanie Tam reporting from the curiously pragmatic and idealistic world of modern-day Esperanto. Now, here's one more thing to consider when thinking about the best language for Earth 2.0. No matter how pragmatic or idealistic a language plan we might manage to draw up, the original blueprint is unlikely to hold. Even if Esperanto were to take hold around the world, it probably wouldn't be long before the Esperantists we spoke with wouldn't recognize it. Language evolves. It diverges. It constantly sparks its own offshoots. Consider a recent group of languages that were created from scratch.
Computer languages are very definitely created. And so somebody sits down and says, this is the way we want to have our language work.
Brian Kernahan is a computer science professor at Princeton. He used to work at Bell Labs, the famous incubator of various operating systems and coding languages. Kernahan himself worked on the Unix OS and the languages Awk and Ample. The first major programming languages were invented in the late 1950s.
The first high-level languages, I would say, would fundamentally be Fortran, COBOL, BASIC, and a language called ALGOL, which was, in some sense, more an academic exercise.
These languages were built for different tasks.
Like scientific and engineering computation, which was Fortran, or business computation, which was COBOL, or even educational computation, if you like, which was BASIC. They're definitely created for a purpose as opposed to being a natural process. On the other hand, once they're created, then there's a pressure for them to evolve.
Just a few years later, In 1961,
a professional journal called Communications of the ACM, in their January issue, had a cover piece of art which showed a schematic version of the Tower of Babel. And it listed on that probably 200 programming languages. The message was, boy, there's a lot of programming languages.
Today, there are at least 1,500 programming languages.
Do we need that many languages? Of course not. Do we use that many languages? Actually, no. The repertoire of sort of most journeyman programmers is probably half a dozen to a dozen or something like that.
The parallel between programming languages and natural languages is not perfect, but still striking. A new language costs time, effort, and money to create, to learn, to maintain. Why, then, has there been so much growth?
People are trying to write bigger programs, and they're trying often to address programming problems, that is, taking on tasks that were not part of the original. And therefore, the language evolves because the environment in which it lives is changing. The resources that are available for programmers, that is, hardware resources, are changing. And the desires of the people who write programs change as well.
Or an optimist would say developing into varieties of pronunciations and accents that display the diversity of who we are.
Michael Gordon speaking now about natural languages.
And that process we've seen over world history many times as things fragment and then they coalesce again and they fragment and they coalesce again. Part of that has to do with tribal tendencies. Part of it has to do with just love of experimentation, regional loyalty, something that sounds aesthetically interesting. And you can end up with something like a guy writing a poem in the late medieval period in the Tuscan dialect, Dante, producing a standard for a language by the act of his particularity.
This kind of change can create chaos, but it's also a hallmark of being human. A dissatisfaction with the status quo, a desire to experiment, to build, to adapt to changing circumstances.
We're champions in the animal world at creating our own niches, right? So taking the environment that we're given and then radically transforming it to suit our needs.
That's Lara Boroditsky, a cognitive scientist at the University of California, San Diego.
And we do this with language as well.
And what is Boroditsky's vision for language on Earth 2.0?
My emphasis would be on preserving diversity and preserving flexibility. So making things really easy to learn and really adaptable to environment, rather than focusing on making something that is exactly the same and common across everyone. I don't know that we can judge that we now have the best solution and we should just build it right in. I'd still want people to learn lots of things through cultural transmission and adjust to their environment the way that we do so well as humans. And so in some ways, becoming more aware of the relationship that we have with language is the thing that helps communication more than simply trying to build one system.
It probably hasn't escaped your attention that just about everyone we've heard from in this series on language has been an academic. They, like all tribes, have their own dialects and sublanguages, which is often not all that decipherable to the rest of us. I asked Shlomo Weber about this. He's an economist.
Yes, at the moment I'm the rector of the New Economic School in Moscow.
So I have to tell you, I love academia. I love academics. I love the research you do. But my one big complaint is this. The way that you academics communicate to the rest of us, to the non-academics, is terrible. Now, I understand these are areas of technical expertise, but this strikes me as its own little Tower of Babel, where, you know, there are academic researchers all over the world doing this amazing and valuable research, which, by the way, is often funded by us, the taxpayers, and yet we can't really participate in it because of the way that you all communicate. So I'm curious to know if we can't solve the language or communication problem globally, if we could at least address this problem.
Believe me, Stephen, I agree with you. You know, I am doing my small part. I try to write newspapers. I go on television to talk about general things and not using the language. But I think it comes back to economics. There are incentives, and the incentives are not to go to tell you about this research. There is nothing in my incentive mechanism, what university or community offers me, go to talk to people who are interested in some kind of simplified version of this research. So for this, you really need to grow as an individual and to understand that indeed the research is supported by your dollars.
Well, I will say this. Honestly, as much as I complain about the gap, I'm grateful for it because I wouldn't have a job if you guys communicated directly to people because basically I am the translator. So keep doing what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing, Shlomo. Okay?
Thank you. And Stephen, you keep doing what you are doing.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. As always, thanks for listening.
Same kiel ciam, dankon pro via auskultado.
We'll be back next week, same time, same station. If you can't wait that long, remember, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe. Thanks so much.
Cảm ơn rất nhiều.
Toda, rabba.
Tarima kasi.
Shukran jazilan.
Muito obrigada.
We'll follow you.